Good morning and welcome to the Eastman Financial Report. I'm Dan Eastman, your host, and today is Thursday, September 21st, 2023. Thank you so much for tuning in to WVW-TV. We appreciate your viewership, and of course, we appreciate your support as well. This programming is brought to you free of charge, no paywall, and no subscription, and that's done through the generosity of donors and sponsors. I'd like to thank our sponsor for my program, Swiss America. Swiss America Trading, which is an American company based in Arizona, and they've been a longtime player in the precious metals market. If you're interested at all in acquiring tangible, physical gold and silver and platinum type investment products, certainly give Swiss America a call at 1-800-519-6271, or you can go to their website, swissamerica.com, and use the promo code Eastman for Eastman Financial Report, and they will send you some free information as to how these tangible precious metals markets and investments work. Of course, you'd want to get the information and do your homework and read up and understand. But in this day and age, with the situation we have, not only at the federal level with the federal budget deficit and the Congress apparently negotiating back and forth today to try and keep the government from shutting down for the second time this year, all of these economic uncertainties suggest that you might want to broaden your horizons with respect to your personal investments, and there may be a place for tangible precious metals in your portfolio. Swiss America is running a special right now that's very, very interesting. If you look at how precious metals are sold, they come looking like coins, of course, and these are minted products. And you can get a Walking Liberty half dollar for an amazing price right now of $13.50 each. And that includes shipping. So you can order these things and they'll be shipped to your house. There we have it right on the screen now. And you can, of course, load up on some precious tangible metals that you can keep in control in your sock drawer or wherever you hide your money. And the nice thing about it is for $13.50, including shipping, that's a great deal. That offer is limited to 250 coins and it only lasts until they run out of these their current inventory. So if you're interested in precious metals at all, this might be a great time for a bargain. I guess for $13.50, you can probably hand them out as gifts or something, but you might want to give them a call, 1-800-519-6271. And take advantage of this special because, as we're going to talk about again today, the economy is the Wild West, and you certainly want to be prepared. So anyway, give them a call, 1-800-519-6271. Okay, let's talk about the news today. And of course, this is another reason why we look at the economy, and it's an unstable situation. We know that the Federal Reserve met yesterday and the day before. It was the 19th and 20th. And of course, they meet periodically. I believe it's 8 times per year unless there's an emergency. And the goal of the Federal Open Market Committee, of course, is to look at the state of the economy and to decide how they're going to apply monetary policy to affect the economy. So if the economy is too slow, they try to do things by cutting interest rates to stimulate businesses and consumers to borrow money, which is cheaper. Cheaper money, we'll borrow it. We can take risk in the marketplace with it. And that stimulates the economy. The same problem is when the economy is too hot and we have inflation, they can use monetary policy by raising interest rates to slow the economy. And of course, that's the famous metaphor of pulling the punch bowl away just as the party's getting started. And of course, we've been watching them pull the punch bowl away and raise interest rates for the better part of a year. And we've seen inflation, at least as reported, last year was in the 9% range, which was truly an eye-popping number, especially for those of us around in the 1970s who saw the social and economic damage of high inflation. And then now it's down to 3%, and they've managed to do that by raising interest rates. And the wake or the trail or the flotsam and jetsam behind that ship effectively has, it's tanked four banks. It's put a lot of stress on the financial infrastructure. It has raised mortgage rates from 2.5% to 3% all the way up to 7.84%, I think this week is the average rate. And of course, that plays havoc with the economy. That's what they're trying to do is slow the economy down. Well, the problem with slowing the economy down, of course, is that it's not an abstract concept. the economy is you and I and businesses, and we all earn money and we spend money, and it's this like this globe of economic activity. When money changes hands, that's the economy, okay? And of course, you know, a bigger economy is better. It's better for everybody, or you're living in a wealthier economy. That's why it's probably better to be poor in America than it is to be poor in some, you know, third world country. It's much better to be poor here, frankly. If you want to be poor, it's a great place to be poor. But the point is, what the Federal Reserve is trying to do is affect this giant ball of economic activity by fiddling with the interest rates. And I've been talking about this throughout the week, that the question becomes, how effective is monetary policy when you think about the size of the economy? And monetary policy does not come without social cost. And of course, the people that get hammered the most are the people in my famous third silos. I break society into three silos. I've got the low income people with no assets. And then you got the middle class who probably have a house and a 401k and a job. And then you got the rich people. And of course, the rich people, they don't care about any of this. This doesn't affect them, okay? Because they're outside of the zone. Where monetary and even federal fiscal policy impacts people is in the middle and on the short end. So when the Federal Reserve is raising the interest rates and mortgage rates react accordingly, the people in the third silo, the poor silo, are trying to get into the middle silo, or maybe take the great leap to become a billionaire tech person. But the problem is they can't buy a house, okay? They can't buy things that go up in value, because they can't get in. And they couldn't get in at 2%. Now they're not getting in at 7.8% either. So these fiscal policies, all they do is raise the interest on the credit card balances, which is, you know, you look at $1 trillion in credit card debt right now. You know, Bill Gates doesn't worry about his credit card debt. He probably uses it as a convenient way to pay digitally. But when you're living, you know, in the first silo here, and you don't have anywhere near enough money, and your children are hungry, and you go to the grocery store and you put food on the credit card because it's either that or don't eat, and then the Fed's, you know, jacking up the interest rates, that's the silo that's getting burned. The middle class is kind of caught. I mean, people are going, you know, from the middle to the poor silo, and every once in a while somebody sneaks out of the middle silo and gets themselves into the big silo. But the reality is that middle silo is getting squeezed. The little silo is growing, is expanding, and monetary policy is burning that group. So you ask yourself the question, if the Federal Reserve creates the inflation with this massive debt, now I used to say $32 trillion, you know, now here it is only a couple of months later, I'm saying $33 trillion. Even though it would take me 56,000 years to hand you $1 trillion once per second, they could hand it out faster than I possibly could. And, you know, in 3 or 4 months now we're at $33 trillion. So it really becomes a difficult situation for the Federal Open Market Committee, because that's the one tool that the federal government has to try and deal with inflation. They're killing inflation, but they're killing it on the backs of the poorest Americans. They're paying the brunt. They're not, the wealthiest people are not suffering from inflation, and they're not suffering from high interest. Because, you know, if you think about it, if you were blessed to have $1 billion, I mean, rich old Uncle Joe dies and leaves you $1 billion, and you take it down to your savings loan and you put it on deposit, and it's 5% interest, okay, you're going to make $50 million a year in interest. Now, that's not too shabby. All you need is that first billion, and you can make $50 million a year in interest without even getting up in the morning. It's free money, right? Well, when interest rates go up and that goes to 7%, then the billionaire gets $70 million instead of $50 million. Now, if you're in the first silo, and I don't want to sound like a Marxist socialist here, but if you're in the poor silo and you're going to the grocery store to pay for your groceries when the billionaires are making $70 million a year interest on each of their billions. This is per $1 billion, okay? That's why, I mean, they're not in this. They're floating around out here looking down on, you know, the government screwing the little guys over with these tax rates or these interest rate jumps. And of course, politically, there's a lot more people in these silos than there is up in the, you know, the wealthy class. Take a look down your block at home or your neighborhood and see how many billionaires. You know, for all the normal people, there's no billionaires because there are so few. So the point is, this monetary policy is very painful for the working class, the poor, the fixed income, everybody except the rich people, okay? And that's why when you ask the question and you get this Federal Reserve that seems to act independent of it, nobody votes, none of us vote for anybody on the Federal Reserve. That we don't. I mean, the President of the United States appoints people to the 7 Board of Governor seats, and those are confirmed by the Senate, but those are 15-year terms. So, I mean, you get through 3 or 4 presidents before somebody's term expires. So they're really not elected or accountable to the people. Yet Congress has delegated the authority to fiddle around with the economy to this, you know, the Federal Reserve. And, you know, that's fine. You have to have a monetary mechanism. But I think from a political perspective, the people in Congress, our representatives, our senators, should be asking the question, if you've created the inflation with $33 trillion in debt, and now you're trying to solve that problem with fiddling with the interest rates, then the only people you're hurting are the very poorest of the poor and the middle class. And the rich are only getting richer as you're raising rates. And inflation's good for them anyway, because if you have a house on Long Island and you bought it for $30 million and now it's worth $40 million and you're getting, you know, $70 million a year interest on your billion, man, life's good. Doesn't matter. Rates go up, rates go down, doesn't matter. It's we the people. It's part of the problem. So I think, you know, for the political, and this is not a political show, it's a financial show, but this financial activity is creating, you know, unrest and discomfort within virtually all Americans, except for the very wealthy. And I think that becomes something that you know, in Congress, through its oversight, ought to be thinking about, is it good policy to be so aggressive on inflation? And wouldn't it be better if you went and, you know, people in the middle who own homes with inflation, that's kind of helping them along. I mean, it's the fact of life. If your house is going up in value, then, you know, your groceries may cost more. But, you know, there's a compensating thing. The same thing if you have a portfolio stock. There are ways to pick stocks. And I suppose I could talk about that someday, why stocks sometimes can be an inflation hedge or do better. In inflation. Like if you take a company that's got all sorts of real estate, well, real estate's going up, so the value of that company should be going up. Or a company that has the ability to pass costs on to its customers because of price inelasticity. What that means is that effectively your customers have to buy your product and they're going to pay no matter what you charge. Those types of companies, you know, might do better in inflationary times. And I don't know anything about the stock market. And I would never recommend a stock to pick, but if you know, you may want to talk to your experts about you know, their inflation protection type companies. So the point is, instead of just fiddling with the monetary policy, shouldn't we be looking at things that are better for the middle class? Like perhaps, you know, no taxes on capital gains on, you know, a portfolio up to $1 million. What's $1 million in a, you know, for you know, in a world full of billionaires? You know, a millionaire doesn't even get invited to the club. So these are all questions that, you know, probably should be addressed at some point, because if they're not, then the system just spins out of control. And you're starting to see that again this week with, you know, for the second time in this fiscal year, you know, your calendar year, federal government is, you know, is coming to a stop. We have to pass 12 continuing resolutions that will allow the federal treasury to continue spending money after September 30th. And of course, you know, the conservative caucus wants certain things, and the Democrats will have nothing to do with any of that. And we're going back and forth and back and forth. And that's the fiscal policy component along with the monetary policy component. And we're watching all of this go on. And the problem is, it's impacting the lives of millions and millions and millions of people. You go to the gas station, gasoline's up, you know, $3-4 a gallon, and go to the grocery store, unless you've been sleeping in a cave for the last 20 years, you go to the grocery store and you notice there are a lot of things that cost more money. And same thing with restaurants. It's stunning to me the number of restaurants that are closing in my community and between Milwaukee and Chicago. Man, it's you know, the mom and pop restaurant era is severely stressed right now, because in order to run an operation, you need to have an infrastructure and you maybe need multiple outlets. It's really the corporatization of a lot of places, because you can't find labor and food prices are through the roof. You can't raise your menu prices. At some point, people just aren't going to go out and spend $150 for a hamburger. They're just not going to do it because there's so much pressure in the system. So the question becomes, instead of trying to fight inflation by tweaking the interest rates another quarter of a point, you know, maybe finding some fiscal responsibility in you know, effectively at least trying to balance a budget and going through all federal expenditures with a fine sharp pencil and start eliminating the astounding amount of money that the federal government is spending. And of course, keep in mind there's infrastructure problems even with that. The biggest spend we have, of course, is Social Security. Okay, Social Security payments are big because the federal government promised the people that they would take, you know, they would tax them and tax their employer and put it in a trust fund. Remember the Al Gore v. Bush election where Al Gore managed to blurt out lockbox. That's all the media needs is to have a keyword. It's in every headline for 20 years, lockbox. Well, it didn't. The idea was that the money was to be segregated in a trust account. And like any other pension, I mean, every other pension in the country, there's a trustee, there's a board of directors, and they put the money in a fiduciary holding. It's segregated, and then they manage it. They hire professional managers, and the money grows. And sometimes they have a setback because the market crashes, but the money's all in the pot, and then they pay these pensions out. And this was how this was structured. The idea was that Americans would be setting money aside, and even George Bush II was saying we should privatize this and make everybody have a 401k with some restrictions that you can't just raid your own pension. Well, the government will raid your pension. You don't have to do it. Well, that's exactly what they did. You know, no sooner do you put a pot of money in front of the politicians in Washington and they spend it. They say, well, we'll borrow it from the trust fund. Yeah, well, now it's all gone. It's all been spent. And now they have to put money back in every year to meet these Social Security pension obligations. So effectively, they ruined that whole thing. I mean, it would have been, you know, like there are many well-run pension and 401k plans that are fully funded, and that ain't the cash. So now you've got that issue. And I think the biggest political issue, and again, this isn't a political show, but it's a financial show for all the people on Social Security, is, you know, they don't want their payments stopped or they don't want their payments cut. And so that's the biggest problem the federal government has. The next is Medicare and Medicaid. Okay, again, they've tried to socialize medicine and structure medicine in such a way that the free market has nothing to do with healthcare provision. This is a world unto itself. People used to say, I don't want the government running their health care. Nobody knows who's running healthcare, but we do know that the federal government's on the hook for Medicaid for all the people on Social Security, the elderly people. As a matter of fact, by law, once you turn 65, the vast majority of people have to migrate to Medicare. Medicaid is, of course, a medical subsidy for the poor people who, for whatever reason, manage to fall through their state cracks and they qualify for Medicaid. So you have Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid are three very large federal programs that rely on current taxpayer funding to fund. But even when you look at the receipts collected by the Internal Revenue Service on people who pay taxes every year, it's barely enough to cover that. Well, then, you know, being citizens of the United States, we like to think of ourselves as having the best military in the world. Well, that doesn't come cheap. And if you know you've got $700 handles and $1,200 toilet seats, the point is the military is very, very expensive. And for our own national security, it would be nice to have a military that defends us from foreign invasion or bombs or whatever. That costs a lot of money. Of course, we spend not only defending ourselves, but we run around the globe, you know, paying money to other people to defend themselves, all because it's good national policy, according to whoever's in power at the time. So defense is another big thing. Okay, so if you take care of the elderly and the poor, and now we got defense, and now there's the rest of it. Okay, there's federal highways and there's federal bridges and there's, you know, there's the ocean studies thing and there's, you know, and then of course you got NASA, you gotta check what's going on in outer space. And all of this stuff costs a lot of money. And at some point, we don't have a budget bill that is passed and signed by the president, and this is the United States budget for the next year or perhaps 2 years, whatever. We do a biennial in Wisconsin, but let's say you had an annual budget, and that was the law, and this is how much money you could spend. And any good manager in any good company, whether you manage a, you know, a hamburger stand or you manage, you know, I don't you know, Apple or General Motors, something big, you function according to a budget. And if you know, as a business person, instinctively, your budget is your roadmap. And if you deviate, that's a crisis, because you are now you're spending outside of your budget. And if it's a crisis, then that crisis needs to be dealt with, because it wasn't foreseen and it wasn't budgeted. And what you want to do is you run it within your budget, and then you hit your numbers. And then, of course, revenues minus expenses is income. Income is up. Income is a return on equity. Your return on equity is big. Your stock goes up. You get a great big Christmas bonus at the end of the year, or end of the year bonus. And lo and behold, you're successful. None of that is happening. Even at the local level, the municipal, you got the mayor, he's got a budget. It was passed by the common council. He signed it, and his job, or her job, I should say, is to manage the city's spending, or the county or the state's spending, within the budget. And of course, like I said yesterday, you like to have a little left over. So all the taxpayers and voters think, oh, what a prudent manager we have hired as our mayor. And then they put that in the rainy day fund. So when there is a blowout, like, you know, you need to pick a dump truck, or, you know, a bridge collapses, you got to clean it all up, you've got extra money to do that. And it doesn't, you know, require a big bulge in the taxes, because our taxes have to equal our spending. Well, we need to find that type of federal discipline. When we were the only power in the world, and John Maynard Keynes' theory of this tax and spend, borrow and spend, that created the $33 trillion in debt, thanks to John Maynard Keynes, may God rest his soul. He died in the 1930s, just before the party got started, just before the feds put the punch bowl on the table. Old John Maynard Keynes cashed in. But at the end of the day, we're kind of stuck in a world where, if this were a company or an organization, and your debts were beyond belief, and your debt service was more than you were taking in, or at least your annual spending was more than you're taking in, and your debt service is approaching how much tax dollars, and that doesn't leave you anything for Medicare, Social Security, all that, then you would do a reorganization. You'd personally file for bankruptcy, and you'd liquidate the company, or you'd bring in a new management team that would say, you know what, we got to get this thing back between the rails here if we want to keep this company alive. And those reactions happen in business and organizations rather quickly. That's why we have auditors. And every year, most companies of any size, they'll either have an audited financial statement, or perhaps just an accountant. Maybe they don't want to spend an audit, or don't need one, their bank doesn't require one. But you look at your annual numbers. And, you know, most companies run on a calendar year. So shortly after New Year's, they're, you know, by the middle of January, here's your numbers for last year. And, you know, you want to see, oh, we beat expectations. If you say, wow, we lost a lot of money last year, we better change our plans right now, or we're going to be broke by June. Well, this thinking needs to start happening with our federal money in Washington. Because I'll tell you, it when you think about what is a national security risk, okay? Well, the Chinese could drop nuclear bombs on us, or the Russians, you know, and apparently they got these supersonic missiles that, for some reason, with all of our insane defense spending, we forgot to invent. So apparently we're coming up short on super duper fast missiles that can bomb us faster than we can bomb them, which is not all that comforting. But the point is, you know, we would have that type of stimulus, and we have to be ready for that. And that's what national preparedness and national infrastructure and all this idea that we've got to be on top. Well, the world is changing place, and you could argue that, you know, from an infrastructure perspective, that when you're carrying $33 trillion in tax load, and your people in the first two silos are really hurting, okay, because inflation is happening, and, you know, interest rates are too high, and nobody can sell their house, and all this stuff is happening, your economy is based upon the wealth and well-being of your taxpayers. You know, how much money can the American taxpayers kick into national defense in an emergency? The answer is not much. You know, same thing. You know, if you look at China, which is an emerging economy, they've got their issues over there, and it's a good thing. But, you know, they got 1.5 billion people to tax. We got 330 million, and half of them don't pay taxes. So you start looking at national infrastructure and national security. The question I ask is, how is this in our best national interest to be $33 trillion in debt, and American taxpayers tapped out, an economy that is limping along with high interest rates that were affected exclusively by the Federal Reserve trying to tweak a system to slow the economy more on people that are already suffering to solve the problem of inflation, which is created by all the money printing. They did it. They created the problem. Now they're trying to solve that problem on the backs of the people. And I think this is not a good place to be financially because, you know, for all of us, we're trying to get by and pay our bills and, you know, live in a, you know, it's nice to live in a home and drive a car and maybe eat some food, and wear clothing, you know, that kind of fun stuff. We need to not have this national federal problem happening. And that's why I watch with almost amusement as we watch Congress, continuing resolutions, but you got to cut spending. You have to agree not to spend $1.5 trillion more than we have. You know, how about you, like, don't spend any more than you have? And maybe you have to start asking these very tough questions. Because what ultimately happens, and if you look back to the collapse of the Soviet Union, this was very telling. Because the Soviet system, everybody got a pension. And they were all living on pensions when they retired because this, you know, each according to their ability and they take according to their needs and it's equal and it's egalitarian. So everybody did whatever they did. It was an old Russian saying, you know, we pretend to work and they pretend to pay us. See, everybody knew it was just, you know, it was nonsense. But you got all these pensioners in Russia, okay? And the Soviet Union collapses, the wall comes down, and the Russian Republic emerges from the wreckage of this. And of course, one of the first things they did is they took the Soviet ruble, which was not convertible easily into Western currency because of Cold War policy, but they re-monetized. And when they re-monetized, and you can search this on the internet and see, I can't remember what the ratio was, but let's say for purposes of discussion, for every old Soviet ruble you had, for every new ruble that the new government issued, you had to cash in like 800 old ones, okay? Which meant that the money, the old money was deteriorating in buying power to get the new money. But they continued to pay the pensioners the same money. So what happened was they got just what they were promised, typical, you know, they got the government promise, they're gonna get 800 rubles a month. They got 800 rubles a month. But in order to take that 800 rubles, it wasn't 800 new rubles, which everybody's using. It was 800 old rubles, and there was an extraordinary discount. So the point is, anybody on a Soviet pension they went broke. Okay, the pension they were getting, you couldn't even buy a loaf of bread. It was devalued, demonetized, and that's why when you think about it from an American perspective. And nobody really complained because there's a new Russia emerging and the young people, the new thing, and it's beautiful. It's the rebirth of a new old nation, you know. But the people who got left behind were living on the fixed pensions and getting paid, you know, the equivalent, which was meaningless. The money they got was meaningless. So that's why it's important to protect your buying power. And of course, if you think about it, how do you do that? Well, tangible assets, real estate. You need to get yourself in the middle silo from this is the silo of the fixed income pensioners, people living on Social Security in America today, and that's all they have. They're in the poor silo. And if this becomes a fiscal crisis and you're $33 trillion and counting, they can't even get this, you know, the Congress to pass these resolutions, and they will. This is, trust me, October 1st, the government will, maybe 10 days, you're going to have a little saber rattling. But at some point, the bell rings. And if you're over here on these fixed income, you better have assets that rise in value. Maybe you can't afford to buy a house, but you probably can afford to buy a $13.50 silver coin because that coin is going to be worth a whole lot of money in a new monetized world. You know, ask yourself the question. I'm going to leave you with this thought. When you look at a one ounce gold coin, the American Eagle gold coin, it's very interesting. You just go over to Swiss America, go on their website and look at both sides of that 1 ounce gold coin. The thing that strikes me is it says $50. $50. Now, if I would have called Swiss America right now and say, hey, I got 50 bucks, give me one of those coins, I'm going to laugh. They're like 2,000 bucks, you know. So how do you explain? Why does it say $50? Because if they remonetize, that's $50. And paper money you got, it's going to cost you multiple thousands to get that one coin that says $50. I'll leave you with that thought. You have a great day. I'll talk to you tomorrow and keep an eye out on what's going on. I'll get the Federal Reserve. Thanks a lot. Bye.